Mohammed Al-Khafaji came to Australia with his family via Syria and Iran when he was 13 after fleeing Iraq as political refugees. Now a resident of Adelaide, he's fluent in Arabic, Farsi, he was a finalist for the Young Australian of the Year, and he became a CEO at just 26 years of age. After working successfully in software engineering, he now puts his skills to use with the Federation of Ethnic Communities Council of Australia, or FECCA, the country's peak body representing people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. Since the pandemic broke out, Mohammed and his team have been at the coalface, exposing and advocating for better messaging around the virus for diverse communities. Mohammed Al-Khafaji, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure. Mohammed, you've chosen 2003 as the year that made you. Why did you choose that year?
Well, 2003 is the year that my family and I came to Australia. It's a significant year, and it's a year you can't forget. It's a, you know, I clearly remember it as if it was yesterday. It's very clear in your mind. I was about, I think, 13 and a half, and my whole childhood was, you know, looking forward to this day. So, yeah, 13th of March, 2003.
So if you could tell us a little bit about what your life was like in those 13 years prior to coming to Australia, Mohammed, and in particular, why was it that your family had to leave Iraq?
Very good question. So my father was heavily involved in the opposition movement against Saddam Hussein, a terrible dictator. My father, because of his work, unfortunately lost 12 members of his family and extended family, you know, and he was standing for social justice and democracy, basically. So he was then forced to leave Iraq for his safety, and he was doing his work in exile. So we grow up as kids, really, minding our own business and really understanding what it is that my father went through and why he did that. And I guess that's where the sense of social justice comes from, for myself anyway. And then as the years kind of went by, my parents realized that, you know, the kids are growing up and they need a future, they need a passport, they need a country to call home. We didn't have Iraqi nationality because we were in exile. At the time in Iran, we couldn't access citizenship and we were there basically as refugees, but there was no future for people like us. So my father then, or I guess my parents decided that it's time to, I guess, apply through the United Nations for refugee status and wait in the virtual queue, if you like, to be resettled somewhere. So for that to happen, we had to move to Syria. And initially, my father thought this is going to be a routine process because we had our refugee status and, you know, the max that we would stay in Syria would be, you know, a couple of years max. And then we would be resettled somewhere. Because of that, we didn't really have too much going on. We didn't really buy things because, you know, we could leave everything behind. I guess our stay in Syria kind of got extended to, you know, to 3.5, 4 years, unfortunately. And in that time, you know, it started becoming, you know, almost a dream. You know, why would a country like Australia take a family of six from Syria to resettle them and give them a new life? It started becoming a dream and a myth.
Well, that's what I was going to say, yeah. Mohammed. Yeah, when you say a dream, did you start to doubt that it would ever happen? And I can only imagine what all that moving around and uncertainty must have been like for a young boy growing up. Looking back on that period now, how do you think all that uncertainty over your future affected you?
Well, uncertainty is the key word here, and it's terrible, really. I mean, for us as kids, we didn't really have to think about much. I mean, we had to go to school, come back, do our homework and, you know, go play outside. But even for us kids, it started to affect us because every night almost we talk about Australia and we talk about, you know, what we would do when we arrive in Australia, what would be the first things we would do kind of thing. So we had the whole thing planned out. But then as days went past and months and years, we started doubting that this thing is actually happening. And also, you know, that self-doubt of, you know, why would anyone do this for us? Why would they take a family of six out of nowhere and give them a new lease on life? So we started doubting that. But I guess looking at the impact of that uncertainty on my parents, especially on my father, you know, not having the right to work for all of that period and, We observed it was actually affecting him quite a bit, and we were helpless. I mean, we couldn't do anything to kind of support our parents. And every time we were out in, you know, minding our business in the streets, and every time we saw a United Nations car go past, there was that little, I guess, slither of hope, thinking that maybe they're coming for us, maybe it's our turn. And then that thought would completely go out of the window.
On the year that made me, we're speaking with Muhammad Al-Khafaji. And Muhammad, 2003 was the year that you got to Australia, but it almost didn't happen. I wonder if I could ask you, firstly, why it was that Australia was so definitely the destination in the family imagination, and then more crucially, how it was that you actually did manage to get here in the end, because I believe it almost didn't happen.
Yes, correct. My father had a family friend that was based in Australia, and we could use his address and his name as a reference if required. And my father was clever enough to reject the United States, and I'm grateful for him for doing that, seeing what's happening over there at the moment. Yeah.
Fair enough.
And it almost didn't happen because there were a lot of hurdles along the way. A couple of years after we've lodged our application to United Nations or UNHCR, we started making inquiries about the progress of the application. And one day we were told that, you know, they've lost our application, which is basically code word for, you know, somebody jumped the queue. You have to start the whole process again. I guess we could have done the same thing, but, you know, after everything that my father has fought for, we weren't going to, you know, do the wrong thing. So we persisted and we kind of reapplied to for refugee status and for resettlement. But the second time round, we kept a closer eye on, you know, the progress. And eventually, you know, as the years went past, my father decided to actually write an email to the Australian ambassador in Lebanon because there was no embassy in Syria. And with his broken English, he said, look, this is what's happened. You know, I'm just kind of following up. Can you please look into it for us? And the ambassador actually responded and said, leave this with me. I'll look into it. And then within like a week or two, she came back and said, your visas are here. You'll be traveling in, you know, 1 or 2 days. So we literally had to drop everything and say our goodbyes. And that was the moment. I remember very clearly I was sitting down. It was late evening, and my father came in and said, we've got the visas, we're going to Adelaide. And we got the map, we said, where is Adelaide? That's not Sydney.
Right.
And we looked at it and, you know, we started dreaming big and we said, look, it's fine. We'll get to Adelaide and then we'll catch the next flight to Sydney. But luckily we didn't have to do that. I'm very grateful for that. And also on the day when we're actually heading to the airport, we got to the airport, we got through security and all of that jazz, and someone was following my father, and he went to him and he said, oh, there's someone outside waiting for you, you know, needs to speak to you. And my father turned around and said, we're done here, see you later. And later on I understood that that person was someone from the security agency in Syria trying to question my father, what's going on, where are you going,
right,
kind of thing.
Having dreamt about moving to Australia for such a long time, what was it like when you arrived in this strange city of Adelaide? How long till it started to feel like home for you, Muhammad?
Well, in my mind, we thought, well, Adelaide is not Sydney. You know, we thought we were going to be the only Iraqi family in Adelaide. But to our surprise, we were actually welcomed by an Iraqi man who himself was actually an asylum seeker at the time. He didn't actually have his, you know, permanent residency, or he wasn't an Australian citizen. He came by boat, but he was volunteering for one of the settlement service providers at the time, and he was happy to, you know, help this Iraqi family who was new to Adelaide. So he picked us up from the airport, and at that time there was a religious ceremony happening in Adelaide, and he said, would you like to come to the mosque? And we said, yes, we'd love to. So our first day in Adelaide, we kind of went to the mosque and met the rest of the Iraqi community here in Adelaide. And everybody was so generous and welcoming. And, you know, everybody started offering to do things for us and come and pick us up to go shopping and so on and so forth. So, yeah, we kind of fell in love with the community and the generosity and the compassion that came with that.
obviously those formative experiences and your personal experience as a refugee has been very influential in the choices that you've made as an adult. In 2015, you were appointed as the inaugural CEO of Welcome to Australia at the age of just 26. How did that come about, Mohammed?
A few years before that, I mean, I was obviously interested in social justice and wanting to kind of give back to the community, really kind of be involved in things that I could help. And at the time, there was an organisation called Welcome to Australia that was starting up, and it was a new, fresh voice in the refugee debate, one that was providing hope and unity around language that was used around asylum seekers. It was the two extreme ends, quite frankly, at the time. But Welcome to Australia was that middle voice where actually spoke to middle Australia and make the refugee debate a little bit more palatable and actually tell the stories of people who are actually affected by it. Mm. So I was interested in that, and, you know, I was happy to share my story. So I started as a volunteer really with the organisation, and the organisation itself was completely volunteer run. And then a few years down the track, I guess we all kind of decided that it's time for this national movement to actually have some staff and to grow their organisation. So we all kind of decided to crowdfund for the position of inaugural CEO. You know, everybody chipped in, I chipped in, and we got enough money to actually get a position going. And once that's happened, the founder asked me to be the inaugural CEO, which, you know, in my response was, dude, what are you doing? I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm still, you know.
Although that investment paid off very quickly for you.
Well, I'd like to think.
And for the organisation, yeah. I'm sure as well, yes.
And for the organisation, that's right. So, look, I mean, the first year, there were fantastic organisations out there that supported us and made that possible. And, you know, the movement is, you know, started growing. And within 2 years, we managed to actually recruit that 8 or 9 people through different funding sources, which was fantastic. I don't know. I don't know what I was doing, but, you know, I trusted my gut feelings, and I was actually supported by amazing people. And now, my wife included now, but at the time, you know, there were amazing people that just kind of supported me and advised me and helped me to run this organization, and really learned quite a lot through that. So I'm very grateful for that experience.
Looking back on the experience that you and your family had and the reception that you received back in 2003 and the way things are for refugees now in Australia, it's a complicated picture, obviously, but what's your assessment of the networks of support that are available now and the overall situation in Australia?
It kind of breaks my heart to see how Australia is treating people seeking asylum who did not come through, you know, quote unquote, the right channels. Mm. We're dealing with people here, people who are absolutely desperate to get out, and they didn't have the luxury of time like my family and I did, you know, waiting in Syria for indefinite amount of time. People are desperate. People don't have resources to be able to kind of sustain themselves for that long. So when people get on a boat and travel to a destination, they are desperate to get out. And then we lock them up and we treat them as if, you know, that public enemy number one. So that didn't really sit well with me. And it's a contrast in how I was welcomed here and how my family and I were treated as refugees when we came to Australia versus how those people are treated. At the moment, we've got a lot of people still locked up in immigration detention. They're refugees. I mean, we need to treat them with respect and with compassion. And also looking at what's happening in Afghanistan at the moment, we've done a great job, I guess, in terms of trying to evacuate as many people as we can, but there is a lot more we can do. There is a lot more we can do, and the public perception around refugees has slightly changed to something a little bit more compassionate as a result of what's happening in Afghanistan. And I really hope that we can capture this moment to really relook at our refugee intake and actually do a lot more than what we're currently doing, because we are capable, we can do more, and we should be doing more. We should do our fair share, and we should be welcoming people. But also at the same time, we've got about, you know, 30,000 refugees living with us in the community at the moment that are on temporary protection visa of some sort. One thing that we could do is give them certainty, because they're living from visa to visa, and they don't have any prospect of permanent residency or Australian citizenship. It's one thing that we can do and provide them with certainty. That's what we should be doing right now.
And that's from somebody who's experienced in a visceral way the uncertainty of not having a status and a future that's assured. One unexpected aspect of your work would have been having to deal with the communications challenges of a pandemic. could you tell us about the work that FECA has been doing since coronavirus arrived in Australia?
Yeah, look, so when the pandemic hit, we were quite concerned that we don't have a rule book on how to deal with a pandemic before, and neither did the government or anybody really. And everybody was trying to scramble to figure out how we protect our communities. We flagged that multicultural communities are actually quite vulnerable. And if we don't actually have a specific plan around how we're actually going to communicate to them, how we're going to make sure that they have access to culturally appropriate healthcare, that things will get really bad. So we kind of flagged that early on, but we didn't know what the plan was because we were waiting to see what the government is going to do. And then unfortunately, the Melbourne towers happened. So we've seen the devastating impact that had, and we said, let's make sure that we learn from that and make sure we work with governments to learn the lessons from that. And we successfully, worked in partnership with the federal government to set up a national advisory group on COVID-19 from people from culturally and linguistically diverse background to be able to advise them on strategies, issues specific to multicultural communities and refugee communities. And that partnership has worked beautifully because we've actually addressed a lot of issues. We've come a long way from 12 months or, 18 months ago, and we fixed things together. And that's, I think, the key point here, because it's easy to kind of criticize governments for not doing enough. But I think the beautiful thing out of this is that we've actually, in partnership, we're working together to try and fix this into the future. And there is an opportunity to work like this beyond the pandemic. Yeah, look, it's a great story, if you like, in how government and community can actually work hand in glove to serve those who were here to help.
Well, on that very encouraging note, we'll say thank you very much, Mohammed Al-Khafaji, for being our guest on The Year That Made Me. Obviously, Australia's all the better for the year that made you back in 2003, and thank you for the work that you've been doing for all of our communities in Australia. We always finish up by asking our guest on The Year That Made Me for a song, a piece of music to finish with. What should we go out with today, Mohammed?
Look, my favourite is From Little Things, Big Things Grow by Paul Kelly. That means a lot to me.
Fantastic. Well, we'll hear it now and say thank you very much, Mohammed Al-Khafaji.
Thank you.
Gather around, people. I'll tell you a story. An 8-year long story, power and pride, the British Lord Vesty, the Vincent Lingari, were opposite men on opposite sides.
Vesty was fat with money and muscle, beef was his business, broad was his door, Vincent was lean. Spoke very little, he had no bank balance, our dirt was his floor.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.